Questions about anything from last time? I'm going to give you some hints about the homework thing today, because one of those problem things is what Stein calls a problem. And they're bigger than an exercise. But I did promise last time that I would demonstrate to you the fundamental theorem of algebra. And the key thing about the fundamental theorem of algebra is it used, or the like a standard proof that everybody loves, it uses the fact that complex polynomials are complex differentiable. And I defined what it means to be analytic last time. So the fact was that the rules of basic differentiation hold for complex valued functions, and that's in the complex sense. So in particular, we're going to know that rational functions are complex differentiable. Where the denominator doesn't vanish. So where the denominator isn't zero. So that I mentioned that at the end of last hour, and now I want to start playing around with these ideas. So that a big fact is that the complex differentiable functions satisfy the Cauchy-Riemann equations. So if I write a function of a complex variable as f of x plus y, the real part would be something, and the imaginary part would be something. If f is complex differentiable, then u and v satisfy something called the Cauchy-Riemann equations. So if f is complex differentiable, meaning analytic, then u and v satisfy the Cauchy-Riemann equations. Which are, let's see, du dx equals dv dy, and du dy equals minus dv dx. So let me give you an example of what I think when I think of those functions. So let's think of f of x plus iy equals x plus iy squared. Then the u would be, let's see, when I multiply it out, the real part would be x squared minus y squared. And the imaginary part would be 2xy. So for that function, this would be the u of xy, and this would be the v of xy. And sure enough, you write out those Cauchy-Riemann equations, and they hold for that function. Okay, so the key to the Cauchy-Riemann equations is that if something's going to be complex differentiable, let's say I've got f of z naught equals w naught, where z naught is x naught plus iy naught. And now I'm going to calculate the derivative of f at z naught. And so the interesting thing about complex derivatives, so here I am at z naught, I'm going to slide in, I can the complex derivative existing there means that if I slide in the horizontal direction, I get the same thing as if I were to slide in along the vertical direction.
And in fact, any direction. But the Cauchy-Riemann equations just check for sliding in along this direction and this direction. That difference quotient is going to be the same. And it would be the same no matter what direction I slid in.
But knowing just these two turns out to be a lot. So the idea is, first I'm going to slide in along the horizontal, and then I'm going to slide in along the vertical. And those two things have to be the same. So let's see, when I slide in along this way, this is going to be x plus I, y naught. And when I slide along this way, this is going to be equal to x naught will be holding steady, and I'll let the y slide down to y naught. Okay, so let's do the horizontal one here first. The horizontal one, I would calculate f of x plus I y naught minus f of x naught plus I y naught. That's the z naught. Divided by the delta z part, that would be x plus I y naught minus x naught plus I y naught. Notice the I y naughts cancel in the bottom. And so on the bottom, I would get just x minus x naught. On the top, I'm going to write these out in terms of the real and imaginary parts. The real parts would be u of x, y naught, minus u of x naught, y naught. That's the real part. And the imaginary part is v of x, y naught, minus v of x naught, y naught. And when you stare at that, you realize you're getting partial derivatives with respect to u. So this is going to go, so the real part is u of x, y naught, minus u of x naught, y naught, over x minus x naught. That's a difference quotient for a partial derivative. And I have plus I times the same thing for the v part. And this is something you did in your exercises about complex functions, that a complex function tends to a limit if and only if the real and imaginary parts tend to that limit, to the real and imaginary parts of the limit. So if that difference quotient is going to exist as a complex limit, these two limits have to exist, and that means the partial derivatives exist. So did I call that dq? Yeah, this is a difference quotient. This dq converges to du dx at x naught, y naught, plus I times dv dx at x naught, y naught. Well, the calculation is very similar in the vertical direction. So in the vertical direction, I would do the same thing, but this time I would have, let's see, I'd have f, the vertical one was x naught plus iy minus f of x naught y naught, of f x plus I y naught. And in the bottom I'd have x naught plus iy minus x naught plus iy naught. This time the x naughts cancel and I'm left with an I on the bottom. And so when you pull it all apart, let's see, I'd get on the bottom I times y minus y naught. On the top, when I pull it apart, I would get f of x naught y minus, let's see, this would be a u, of x naught, y naught. And then I'd have an I times I here. They'd cancel. And this would be the V's. V of x naught y minus V of x naught y naught.
So notice this is the real part, and that would tend to dV dy. This is the partial derivative with respect to y of V.
So if that difference quotient converges, this one would converge to, let's see, the real part would be dV dy at x naught, y naught.
And this is 1 over I times the partial derivative of u with respect to y. And 1 over I is minus I.
So I'll have here minus I. Minus I is 1 over I. And the thing that goes in front of this one is du dy at x naught, y naught. Well, if you go back to my first one here, I'll put this in a big red box. That's the derivative when I slide in horizontally. And this is the derivative when I slide in vertically.
And they've got to be the same thing. In fact, I could slide in along any direction, and I'd get a complex number, and they'd all have to be the same complex number. So when you equate real and imaginary parts, you see the Cauchy-Riemann equations. du dx is dv dy, and dv dx is minus du dy.
So there's the Cauchy-Riemann equations. So equate the red box to get the Cauchy-Riemann equations.
Well, at the moment, all I care about are rational functions of z. And I claim now that we can see that the real part of a rational function of z has to be harmonic.
So here's a little fact. Let's write R of z is P of z over Q of z, where these P and Q are polynomials. R is analytic. So the Cauchy-Riemann equations hold. And now I'm going to claim that the real and imaginary parts of R are harmonic functions. Real part of R of z and the imaginary part of R of z are harmonic. Okay, why is that? And it turns out to be easy.
First of all, as real functions, those are infinitely differentiable.
So because this is a polynomial, it's easy to see that these are C infinity smooth. So step one, U and V are C infinity smooth as functions of x and y.
That's because we've got polynomials and quotients of polynomials, so nothing bad can happen. At least where the Q is not zero.
So where the denominator is not zero. Okay, so that's easy. And step two is to use the Cauchy-Riemann equations. So we have the Cauchy-Riemann equations. I'll write them like this. Let's see, we got du dx equals dv dy. And we got du dy equals minus dv dx. Okay, let's call these A and B. And this is so simple. Let's see. If I take, I want to get the Laplacian of u. So I'm going to take du by dx of a, and then I'm going to take du by dy of b, and add them together. Okay, so here's the plan. I'll take du by dx of a. That would give me uxx equals vxy. And now I'm going to take d by dy of b. That would give me uyy equals minus vyx. And because u and v are c-infinity smooth, well, these two mixed partials are going to be equal if the thing is c2 smooth. So that's something you learned in freshman calculus, or no, sophomore calculus. Vxy equals vyx if v is c2 smooth. And it's c-infinity smooth here, so we're safe.
And so this is equal to, this is, that means that uxx is minus uyy.
So we conclude uxx is minus uyy. So in other words, that means that the Laplacian of u is equal to 0. So the aha is Laplacian of u is identically 0, and that means u is harmonic.
And similarly, you can do the same thing for v. Let's see, if I was going to mess around with v, I'd take d by dy of a and d by dx of b and see the same thing. The mixed partials are equal, and you would see that that v is harmonic too.
So similarly, very similarly, v is harmonic. And now I can prove the fundamental theorem of algebra
very easily. So
this is going to be a proof of the fundamental theorem of algebra.
Suppose I have a polynomial that has no zeros in the complex plane.
So suppose, you could assume that the coefficients of P are real if you want, but you might as well take them to be complex. So let's suppose that P of Z is a complex polynomial. With no zeros in the complex plane.
All right, so the fundamental theorem says there is a zero. And then when you have that zero, you can factor it out. And after you factor out, that what's left would have a zero until you get down to a constant. And so this allows you to factor polynomials over the complex plane. That's cool. So it means to understand real polynomials, you got to go complex.
So we're assuming there's no zeros.
That means that 1 over P of Z is a analytic function on the whole complex plane.
It's a rational thing. Then 1 over P of Z is analytic on C. Let's see, I want to suppose that the degree, if the degree is 0, this is dumb. So it's a complex polynomial with degree bigger than or equal to 1. So degree P is bigger than or equal to 1. So it's not a constant.
I claim that this thing is going to be a bounded analytic function because polynomials have to get big for big Z.
So let's, first of all, I claim 1 over P of Z is bounded on the complex plane. So I'm going to use that Liouville theorem for harmonic functions. That's the plan. let's see why that's true. Let's write P of z, let's see, it's degree n, so I'll have a n z to the n plus blah 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 plus a1 z plus a0, where this a n is not 0 and n is bigger than 1, bigger than or equal to 1.
I claim that this polynomial is going to get big in just like z to the n. So when z is big, these other terms are going to be negligible compared to the first one.
And so when you're thinking in like that, it means you should pull out the dominant term. So I'll pull out the z to the n. And what's left would be a n. This next term would be a n minus 1 over z plus blah, blah, blah. This would be a1 over z to the n minus 1 plus a0 over z to the n.
And when z is big, this stuff is really small.
So this stuff goes to 0 as mod z goes to infinity. All right, so think about that. That stuff inside the brackets there would be, an is not 0, so let's make, here's the origin. Here's an that's not 0. And I want to make this polynomial look like something times z to the n. And I want that something to be kind of close to an. So if you think about what I need, I'm going to draw a circle of radius, let's see, it's going to look like this. This radius is going to be mod an over 2.
That way I stay away from the origin. And if I make this stuff here less than that,
that would guarantee that this, let's call this stuff here h of z. This would be a n plus h of z. It would be stuck in there. Okay, so what I see is that
this is going to be bigger than a n over 2.
So I claim, since that stuff's going to 0, there is a radius, an r bigger than 0, such that that an plus h of z is, I guess I should write it like this. It's bigger than a n over 2 if mod z is bigger than r.
It's because that stuff's going to 0, so I can squeeze it inside the circle. And when it's inside the circle, any red dot that's in here is bigger than a n over 2. Okay, so that shows me that my polynomial is big. So my p of z, remember that was that would be z to the n times my a n plus h of z. That's going to be bigger than c times z to the n. Where my c is mod a n over 2 when mod z is bigger than that r. So the polynomial is humongous. It's nowhere near 0 when I'm outside this thing. And it's growing like z to the n out there. in modulus. So when I take 1 over it, it's shrinking like crazy for big Z.
So now, we see that the limit, as mod Z goes to infinity, of P of Z, is 1 over P of Z, is equal to 0.
That means I've got a bounded analytic function on the whole complex plane. See, so let's see, how would I make it bounded? Since it's going to 0 for big Z,
I guess this is being a little bit overkill, but why,
if it's going to 0 at infinity, why is it bounded?
If I was going to graph it, so here's the complex plane, C, and here's the modulus of 1 over P in the vertical direction. It would look like it's got to go to 0 at infinity, so it looked like this
little bump, but it would flatten out, and this would get real flat far away. So if I wanted to show it was bounded, it's easy to show it's bounded outside some big circle, but how would I see it's bounded on the inside? Yeah.
So I guess the details, so I claim 1 over P of Z is bounded. I already claimed that once, but this time I'm going to claim it and show it. So since it's going to 0 for big mod Z, there would exist an R bigger than 0 such that 1 over P of Z is less than 1, say, if mod Z is bigger than R.
Because it's going to 0. So that if I take epsilon to be equal to 0 in the limit definition, if I take epsilon equal 1 in the limit definition, I can say that.
And now, you noted that 1 over P, since it's not vanishing, is continuous. On the complex plane.
And this, the rest of the thing there on C,
so it's also continuous on the disk of radius capital R about 0 closure.
That's a closed and bounded set. It's the big closed circle of radius R. And a continuous function on a closed bounded set assumes a max.
So the word for closed and bounded is compact. This is closed and bounded. And so I've got a continuous function on a closed and bounded set. It assumes a max. So 1 over P of Z modulus assumes a max. On that closed and bounded set. Let's call its max M. And now if you want to bound on that complex plane, the max of M and 1 is a bound on C.
Well, the real part of a complex function is less than or equal to its modulus. So if you think about it, if I have a complex number Z, here's the origin. This is the real part of Z, and this is the imaginary part of Z. So it's a simple, it's the leg of a triangle business that the real part of Z
is less than or equal to the modulus of z. And the imaginary part of z is less than or equal to the modulus of z.
So if I take the real and imaginary parts of the 1 over p, they're bounded too.
And so the aha here is the harmonic function u equal to the real part of my 1 over p of z, and v equal to the imaginary part of 1 over p of z are bounded harmonic functions on the whole complex plane. And Liouville's then implies they're constant. And that's a big contradiction. How could they be constant? That would imply that the polynomials are constant. That implies that P of Z is constant. And that's nuts. I've got a polynomial degree 1. Let's see, why can't a polynomial be constant? I usually get people stumped when they start. They say, of course it's not constant.
Doesn't have a constant derivative.
That's right. So in fact, if I wanted to show you a derivative that wasn't constant, I would take the nth derivative.
So why is that a contradiction? If I were to take the nth derivative of p, it's equal to n factorial times an.
And that's not zero. So there's no way it's constant, because if that was constant, that would be zero.
So if you really wanted to jam it in somebody's face, that's what you would say.
So I just proved the fundamental theorem of algebra. I assume there were no zeros, and I get down to this contradiction. So there was a zero. That's the proof. And so it just involves some kind of simple things about harmonic functions that fall out of the Poisson formula. That was the point today.
I couldn't resist doing that since we had all the tools ready to go.
There's another Liouville theorem about analytic functions, that a bounded an analytic function on the complex plane has to be constant. And so in my complex variable class, that's how I would demonstrate the fundamental theorem of algebra. But this works too. Questions about that?
Yeah. You got that it would bound it from the fact that it's continuous.
Well, it has to go to zero to infinity.
Right.
So that was the critical part of that.
Right. And you got that it was continuous from the fact that it's a polynomial with no zeros.
The Q has no, yeah, so wherever, you know, the rules of continuity would hold for complex. Polynomials are continuous.
Right.
And I've got quotients of things. So quotients of continuous things are continuous,
right,
where the denominator doesn't vanish.
Okay.
Yeah. And the rules of differentiation hold also. So if you were going to slow down and take a semester to do this, like you do in 425, I'd spend some days to show you that all the rules you know about differentiation hold for complex functions. But that's really routine. I'd bore you to death if I did that. Because the proofs look exactly the same as your freshman calculus proofs. So that's pretty cool. Other questions about anything? I wanted to talk about that homework today because I don't want you to freak out about it. I mean, Stein gives you every little hint you need, and there's a couple hints that are a little bit obscure that I want to make sure you get, rather than waste a lot of time thinking about them. So one of the hints is that the sine function
You're going to change sine theta over 2 in the denominator by theta in an estimate. And so you've got to think about sine theta versus theta. Here's a graph of y equals theta, and the blue one, of course, is y equals sine of theta. And you're gonna need the estimate that sine theta is less than theta for all theta. Anybody prove that? Yeah.
So they only intersect at theta equals 0, and then I just took a random point, like pi or something, and said that theta is greater than sine theta.
Yeah. So you... That... Let's see what... Yeah, so you're right. You only have to prove this where until that red line gets bigger than 1. The sine theta stays less than 1. So you only have to prove this inequality, oh, let's see, here's pi over 2. Certainly it's, we're done checking, we can get it done from minus pi over 2 to pi over 2. Because after that, the red line's bigger than 1 and the blue stuff's less than 1 in absolute value. And plus, these functions are both odd, so I only have to prove it for positive theta. Let me say, when I take absolute value, they become even. So if I prove it for positive theta, I've got it for negative theta. But I think I need to check it between 0 and pi over 2, for example. How would I get it there if I wanted to prove it?
With Taylor's theorem?
Taylor's? When I was talking to somebody in my office, I wanted to use convexity, because the sine function is concave down, and therefore it peels downward off that tangent line. But then I thought about it some more with them and realized, oh, it's easier than that.
Can't you just take the derivative?
Derivative?
Yeah.
So yeah, the derivative would be cosine.
So
right?
Since they're equal at 0, and the derivative is greater than or equal to the derivative of sine theta for all theta. That must be true.
Yes. You could turn that into a proof.
Isn't that sufficient?
What?
Isn't that sufficient since they're equal there?
Are you saying the derivative of the y equals theta is always 1, and the derivative of sine of theta is
so it always grows
less
faster than the sine.
That's true. Right. So if you wanted to prove stuff like that, I would suggest mean value theorem. I would look at sine theta minus sine of 0 over theta minus 0 by that would equal to cosine of something. Cosine of alpha, where alpha is between something between alpha and theta. And cosine is always less than or equal to 1. That's what you're saying. The derivative is always less. The derivative of sine theta is always less. The derivative is cosine, and that's all. You're right. It's always less than or equal to 1. So I mean, if you had to prove it, I believe this would be a proof. Okay, so that's a hint for that one. So that means you're going to, when you estimate these integrals, you can replace this sine theta over 2 by theta. Because this inequality goes the right way for the denominator switch. Let's see, what else did I... So you're going to be messing around with, after you make this observation, you're going to be messing around with an integral from minus pi to pi of sine n plus a half theta over theta. And it's going to be the absolute value of that. This is an even function.
this is odd, odd, so I divide them, I get an even function. And when I take the absolute value, it's even.
So it's important to realize this is even. Including that absolute values. And so this is going to be equal to 2 times the integral from 0 to pi. Okay, so that's an important step. And now when you... Stein gives you a fantastic hint here, but it makes you feel like you're doing something wrong. So obviously when you're going to change this, you're going to compare this somehow, and Stein wants you to compare it to an integral from pi to n pi. And you're going to get a new variable here, sine psi over psi. And that's going to bother you a lot. Because you're going to do the change of variables and you're not going to get these limits of integration. Okay, so the change of variables, you're forced though to use the change of variables. Psi has got to be that n plus a half pi. So psi has got to be 1/2 n plus a half pi. I mean 1 plus a half, n plus a half theta. And when you do that change of variables, the integral from 0 to pi is going to go from 0 to n plus a half pi. So when you do the change, you're going to get an integral from 0 to n plus a half pi. Not what Stein seems to be telling you you're supposed to get. Did anybody grapple with that and come up with the answer, what you're supposed to do? Yeah.
You can just write the integral as 0 to pi and then pi to, well, you. I guess you could check. You should do two kind of breaking apart integral things. So you go 0 to pi and then... And then plus the n pi plus
right.
To the n plus 1/2 pi.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's exactly what you have to do. So you get this part, and this is the part Stein wants you to focus on. And this part is a little... This is a little thing. It goes from n pi to n plus a half pi.
This is just a number. This is perfectly continuous. Remember, this famous limit is 1 at 0. So this is just the area under a little hump.
And that's what you notice, that O of 1 in Stein's equation.
That O of 1 is this. This is a constant.
And O of 1 means that those things are equivalent up to sort of a constant. So I would call this a constant and let it float along. And this thing, whatever it is, we're integrating sine of psi over psi. This thing is greater than 0.
And remember, we want a greater than inequality. So we're starting out with something we want to show it's bigger than a constant plus this thing, that this thing really is the meat. And this is just a little piddly number to add on the end.
So we can chuck it. So we'll call this a constant C. And so we see that this is greater than C plus. And so it's this that we have to show gets big in a bad way.
And so that's a big hint.
By the way, this the integral you're going to study, let's see. I want to show you the integral test. You're comparing harmonic series to log terms. And so remember when you were in freshman calculus and you did the integral test for 1 over t? So you graphed 1 over t like this. Here's a graph of 1 over t. This is the t-axis. And let's see. To do the integral test, you would have... two cases to think about. So here's 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. I want some that go under and some that go over. So the ones that go under are these. And I would go out to n here. And so let's see, the under ones would be 1/2 plus 1/3 plus blah, 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 out to n minus 1. No, out to 1 over n. Those are underneath the integral from 1 to n of 1 over t dt, which is the log of n. And the funny thing is, this is exactly what you're going to compare your thing to. Yeah. So you're going to get this sum when you... And that's... yeah, so log of n is even bigger. And it's not log of 2, it's log of n. And the ones that are bigger would be this, 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 etc. And you'd see that these are less than, let's see what that one would be, 1 over 1 plus 1 over 2 plus... And the last one would be this one. And so the last one would be 1 over n minus 1. So that harmonic series blows up exactly like log n. And so that's why you can compare it. You're going to get this when you mess around with your integrals. And that's how you're going to be able to see that they blow up like log n. By the way, that famous integral you're going to calculate in the next problem, it converges by the alternating series test. So if I look at sine t over t, or sine theta over theta, these humps get smaller and smaller. And so the alternating series test says, here's a negative thing, this is a smaller negative thing, and an even smaller negative, see, they alternate. I claim this, that you'll see that the integral from 0 to infinity of sine theta over theta, that's a convergent integral, exists by the alternating series test. Because those areas are getting smaller and smaller, and they're alternating in size. And here's an interesting thing, but the integral from 0 to infinity of sine theta over theta d theta is infinite when I take the absolute value. And the way to see that is to compare, see, if I take one hump, I go from n pi out to n plus 1 pi. And that would be one hump of the sine function. Let's take this to be sine of theta, absolute. I can write on that interval that, let's see, I'd have n pi is less than theta is less than n plus 1 pi. And so when I take 1 over that, I'd get 1 over n plus 1 pi is less than 1 over theta is less than 1 over n pi. And now I'll multiply that by sine of theta and integrate. Absolute sine of theta and integrate from n pi to n plus 1 pi.